They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
So Paul Westhead is a familiar name in NBA circles. He spent parts of six seasons as an NBA head coach, another half a dozen or so as an assistant, spent many years in the college ranks, and is the only coach in history with an NBA and a WNBA championship. He is also the author of the new book called The Speed Game, and he joins me now on the podcast. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure, Chris.
So I guess start with me at the basketball beginning. How does a coach at LaSalle wind up with the Los Angeles Lakers?
Yeah, well, it goes back to my, you know, St. Joe's College background. You know, I played for Jack Ramsey and also playing for Ramsey was Jack McKinney, who while I was a player was an assistant with Ramsey. So then Jack McKinney gets the job as the new Lakers coach, and he calls me and says, I'd like you to come and be with me. Took me about 7 seconds to say, let me think it over. Yes, I'm coming. And back then, head coaches in the NBA only had one assistant. So it was, you know, was kind of an honor for McKinney to invite me, and I was happy to oblige.
Well, it seems almost impossible to believe a day when there was only one assistant. Now I think there's one assistant per player, right?
Exactly. There's six on the bench and six behind the curtain and six that only do workouts. So yeah, it's a changing times there.
So I mean, for people that can't recall a time like that, like what are your responsibilities as an assistant coach in those days?
Well, you did a little bit of everything. And I have to add to this, you and the head coach did about 80% of the scouting. So as you now know, there's a scouting division on NBA teams that probably is 10 plus guys with a director, et cetera. Back then, there would be a part-time guy that would fill in some games. So for example, I would coach a practice with Jack McKinney on a Tuesday at noon and leave that afternoon to fly to Oakland to see the Warriors play that night and then fly back on a midnight flight back to LA and be at practice the next day at 10 a.m. So, you know, it was kind of a whirlwind thing. And you never thought anything of it. I mean, that was expected of you, and we did it.
So, you were an assistant for what? How many games were you officially an assistant coach?
Yeah, Jack had his serious bicycle injury. We were about 10 games into the season. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, 10 games into your first season as an NBA coach, and you're then subsequently being asked to take over the Los Angeles Lakers. What was that moment like?
Well, it wasn't much of a decision because Jack was injured on like a Thursday, and his wife found him as an unknown bicyclist Thursday evening. We went to the hospital, and Friday morning, I had to go to a shoot-around practice because we were playing that night. So it was me, the players, and the trainer. Mm. So I think they made a quick vote and said, let's let Westhead take the team rather than. So it wasn't a lot of, discussion. And I do remember Jerry Buss seeing me later that day saying, okay, you're in charge of the team and, you know, we'll stay in touch with you as the days go by. Because the real concern at that moment was for Jack McKinney. He was in very serious condition.
So show of hands, you know, for who's taking over.
Yeah, and then after the game, come back and see us. We may have made a change by then. And the irony And I talk about this in the book. That first game was kind of a blur, and we're losing with about 15 seconds to go. And Jamal Wilkes does a classic, you know, jump shot that looks like it's never going to go in. I mean, I don't know if you remember Jamal. Mm. Great scorer, but he had an awful shot. It kind of rolled off his head, and it went in, and we won the game. So I probably would have been dismissed after that game had we not won.
How did you feel early on, not only coaching a young Magic Johnson, but, you know, Kareem, who was well established at that point?
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, it was a mixed bag with the Lakers. Kareem and I, through training camp in the first 10 games, had a kind of a friendship that was evolving. And the friendship was, I didn't tell him too much about basketball. I sometimes would talk to him about a novel that I had read or a poem, but not like, hey, I think you ought to dip your shoulder. You know, I was too smart to advise him, and he was gracious enough to accept my advice. So we were friends. So that part got off well. Magic, he was just a young fellow finding his way. So he was kind of easy to handle. I mean, he just wanted to play, you know, just get me out there. Let me play. Let's not have a lot of discussion. So he kind of fit. Even though he's a rookie, he fit like Kareem. They just were players. There were other players, you know, I had issues with Spencer Haywood, for example, because he was traded to us and had an agreement, apparently, with Jack McKinney to be a starter. And Jack McKinney never told me of that agreement. And therefore, I said to Spencer, well, that might be his deal, but it's not my deal. You know, I'm going to play who I think can help us win. So, some of the veterans tried to squeeze me, I think.
How'd you deal with that?
Yeah, well, the good news is I had, you know, 9 years of head coaching experience at LaSalle College. So, I mean, I knew the game. I knew players. I didn't know the pro player. That eventually caught me. But I knew the interaction of players. You know, basically, they want to play. They want to play minutes. And if they do well, they expect more minutes. So I kind of, you know, followed that pattern. You know, if you played well, I played you more. So most of them accepted that right from the get-go.
You said that eventually caught you. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is I thought I was an experienced coach. And if there was a coaching decision on the court or who to play or who not to play, I thought I was okay. You know, I had a good background. But I didn't know anything about agents. I didn't know anything about contracts. I didn't know, for example, that I would say to a player, you know, if you play better defense, you could really help our team and it would help you. And then he comes back 2 days later and says, well, coach, I talked to my agent. My agent says I need to score more points. So I didn't know that world. And I didn't realize at that time that the agent is really important. You know, I just kind of thought it was like the next door neighbor, you know, in a college, you know, my neighbor says I should shoot more. Yeah, well, shut up and don't worry about your neighbor. But the agent is telling him, I can make more money for you if you listen to me and not to him. So there is a conflict there.
That's interesting because that's definitely true now as well, you know, where the agent has a lot of juice and has a lot of influence over the player. Is it? Yeah, you know, we'll get into this, but you did coach in the NBA into the early to mid 2000s. Right. Did you feel like did that evolve at all? Did you feel like the agent had more influence back then or as where we are right now?
Yeah, let me say it in this way. I think it had greater impact on me back then because I was totally naive to that world. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't. I'm talking to you like I know what's going on, but back then I didn't. As I began to coach more teams, like when I had the Denver Nuggets, you know, 10 years later, I could handle it better. I wasn't. Sometimes you still can't win that battle. I mean, the team wants to do one thing, and you want to do something else. even with the Orlando Magic, I can remember in the draft, we wanted player X, and the team wanted Dwight Howard because he, you know, was a young high school phenom, and they could sell him. Mm-hmm. So that world still goes on. I mean, I think people don't realize that there is a significant difference between the head coach and the coaching staff and the general manager and the general manager staff. They say they want to win, and they do, but they see the way to winning going different directions. And I will say to you that the coach probably wants to draft somebody who he thinks can help him immediately, like in the first half of the season, and that season. The general manager might say, well, you know, the season's a throwaway anyway, so hell, we're not going anywhere, so we should, you know, do this and that, and we'll be better 3 years from now. Well, guess what? I'm not going to be there 3 years from now. I'm going to be gone. So that kind of stuff I think I got better at, but ultimately you don't win those battles sometimes with management.
Okay. Can you recall any specifics of a battle that you lost that you look back on now and you can appreciate more?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. And some of my NBA jobs, like when I coach the Chicago Bulls, you get who you're dealt with, and you come in late. I came in late. The draft was like the day after I signed my deal. At that time, we drafted Quentin Daly, who, you know, and then I coached him for a year. I had no issue with Quentin Daly as a player. He was really a talented young man. You know, he had social issues. He had a law case against him that had to be resolved, and there were, unfortunately, there were cities that, you know, made fun of him and called him a criminal and all that kind of stuff. It was hard to go through, but so he wasn't my pick, but he worked out good. I mean, he was my best player. You know, it took me about 2 weeks to say, all right, so at the end of the game, we're going to get the ball to Q. And he was my Michael Jordan. He was my, you know, Tracy McGrady when I was in Orlando. So sometimes it works out okay for you.
You got to Chicago a couple years too early there, Paul.
Yes.
Just a couple.
Yes, I'd still be there maybe.
It's funny how life works out.
Yeah, it is. And my wife keeps reminding me about, you know, teams and how it could have turned. She keeps saying to me, one more championship and we'd have a house with a view.
Should say, I wrote a book. Come on, that's next.
So I wrote a book. See how that helps us, dear.
You know, you were an advocate of playing fast, obviously.
Yes.
That has become en vogue in today's NBA. I mean, Mike D'Antoni introduced his 7 seconds or less offense. I mean, you have talked about this. You were kind of 5 seconds or less
Correct.
In a way in your day. Did you feel, looking back, that, you know, you were ahead of your time? That, you know, getting the buy-in from players must have been a lot more difficult then than it is right now.
Well, you know, Chris, I don't want to take too much credit for the game today because, to be honest, my fast break system is much faster than what I'm seeing today. So to say, you know, the game is playing quickly and you did it many years ago, they're not playing like me. So I don't want to take any credit. I played much faster. If my team had 100 offensive possessions, we wanted to shoot the ball 100 times within 5 seconds. That doesn't go on today. The teams are much more methodical, you know, much more controlled. Mike D'Antoni, you make a good allusion. He was a terrific fast break coach in Phoenix. And by coincidence, I was there with the Phoenix Mercury at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I had the women, he had the men. He'd watch me at practice and games. I would do the same with him. I have nothing but high praise for Mike D'Antoni. But I will say to you, the Mike D'Antoni of the last 5 or 6 years in Houston, for example, that's not the fast break Mike D'Antoni that I knew, mm-hmm. that I associated with. You know, so the running game as I devised it, you know, shoot whatever you can get, a layup or a jump shot in 5 seconds, that went away. And it went away for a lot of reasons. Players don't like it. It's too hard. Mm-hmm. They don't want to play like that. So even if they can get advantage from the defense because they're getting down ahead of the defense, I often marvel how people don't realize this. Why wouldn't you want to have an offense that you can get good shots before the defense gets set? Why wouldn't everybody want to do that? Mm-hmm. And the answer is players don't want to do it because they have to run too hard. Mm-hmm. So that's it in a nutshell.
Well, when you're trying to explain that to, let's just say the Lakers, for example, like how are they receiving it?
Well, the Lakers is an interesting sample because when I took over the team, it was really Jack McKinney's system,
right,
which he got from Ramsey at Portland and the Trailblazers that won the championship with this kind of very sharing type of offense. So I just kind of followed the cue and stayed on target with them. The second and into my third year is when I tried to deploy my fast break. I tried to adjust my system to what they were doing. And to be honest, I experienced, great resistance.
You got fired for it, Paul.
Yeah, I got fired for it. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, you got to the bottom line, Chris. Yeah,
fired for it.
But even in training camp, they just, we had won. We had a championship on our backs. We had a terrific second year with Magic being out for most of the year with knee surgery. Mm-hmm. I thought it was the best team I ever coached in the NBA my second year. And then in the third year, I said, we're going to really rev up the running. And they just resisted. The guards like Magic and Norm Nixon didn't want to run that fast. Magic really wasn't back yet from his knee. People forget that, but I didn't. That really hurt our team early on. Kareem was very compliant, but he was not a fast break guy. I mean, people talk about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. If he was 20 years old today, what would he be in this, open running game? I think a smart coach would take their time and throw him the ball in the low post. You don't want Kareem shooting 25-foot jump shots just because it's in vogue. So it was a hard one. And to be honest, I probably was stubborn. And I said, well, I know that this is a good system and it will work and we can win more games. I think it was Scott Osler who covered our games then. And he said, Paul, why did you change when Jerry Buss gave you a good contract, said you were a great coach, you won a championship? Why change, Paul?
Yeah.
And I said, yes, yeah, Scott, why change? And it was a good question, and I still am trying to figure out the answer. My wife is saying to me, why did you change? You got fired 14 times by doing this crazy stuff. But the few times that it worked, it was worth it, Chris. But back to the Lakers.
Your wife just wanted a house, Paul. You know that. We're still stuck on the house. She wants a better house.
Yeah, she still wants the better house. There you go.
Sorry, continue. You said with the Lakers.
Yeah, but I mean, back with the Lakers, I just probably miscalculated how much they wanted to run. And I thought I could show them a better way. I'll just give you an example. At the end of our first practice in Palm Springs in training camp, we had a good hour and a half practice, a lot of fast breaks. And I thought I'd really not rub it in, but make it better. I said, okay, now we're going to run some lines, guys. So, a lot of college and high school coaches run lines at the end of practice to kind of get you in better shape. So we ran the line, so up, back, up, back, up, back, about half a dozen or 10 times. And the players are walking into the locker room, and I'm walking away from them. And Kareem comes over, puts his arm around me, and says, Paul, I don't run lines. And he walked away. So the good news is he was considerate enough to tell me the ultimate, it was kind of like a threat. If you do it again, I'm leaving. and I think he liked me enough to say, I think you're smart enough not to do it anymore. And I was smart enough. We never ran lines again. But I didn't get the whole message. He probably should have said, and let's slow down a little bit. And
I
the other
think,
thing about, yeah,
go ahead, Paul,
I was going to say, the other thing about Kareem was kind of interesting. We had a good relationship, but he never called me coach. He always called me Paul. I think he only called John Wooden coach. So he was making that clear separation. You're just another guy.
can almost respect that. Like there's one coach, everybody else is somebody else.
Yeah.
At least that coach is a great.
Yeah, I was okay with that. Kareem was fine.
I think there are some people that might listen to this and hear you say, you know, the Lakers didn't want to run as much and be like, you know, what are you talking about? It's the Lakers, the Showtime Lakers. All he did was run in those days. What's the difference?
Yeah, well, they didn't want to run as fast and as many times as I wanted them to run. I think after I was fired, I think Pat Riley came in and kind of kept the running system going and tempered it, though. You know, I think he kind of handled it and handled the players better than I was doing. So I give Pat that credit. I think he still was doing much of my system, but he kind of tweaked it and took it more under control, and the players, I think, responded to that. So, but you don't see that kind of running going on now. I mean, I saw most of the Lakers in the bubble in the finals. Anthony Davis, sometimes Miami was scoring, Davis would get out and run, and they'd throw a lead lob, and he'd dunk the ball ahead of the defense. I mean, that's good fast break. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the next time down, they'd walk it down, and Davis would shoot a 35-footer, you know, mm-hmm. So – it wasn't fast break after fast break after fast break. See, that's really the key of what I tried to do. That's the crux of it. I mean, anybody can fast break and steal the ball and you fast break. I mean, it looks okay. But nobody except me wanted to run it every possession. Push it, push it, push it. If you shot in 5 seconds, the next one, if you could shoot in 4, I'd be happier. Mm-hmm. So it's the relentless fast break that makes it work and blows it up if it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. So Riley was a broadcaster, right? Before he joined you. So you effectively gave Riley his first shot.
Yes, I did. He was with Chick Hearn. He was Chick Hearn's color man. Mm-hmm. And for the first maybe 10, 12 days, it was me and the trainer. And then I had one of the players I don't know if you remember this fellow, Don Ford was a player on our team. And I asked him to like take some notes and give me some advice during the game. And after about 2 games, he said, Coach, I don't want to do this anymore. I think the players thought that he was a plant or something. You know, like, hey, I don't want to do this, Coach. And they're not going to give me any more money for it, so you're on your own. So I asked Pat Riley, and he said yes. And it's really funny how the yes came. He said, I had to get Chick's approval. Because Chick Hearn really was running the show. When Jerry Buss took over the team and bought the team, the resident, he wasn't the owner, he didn't have any money in it, but the resident guy who ran the Lakers was Chick Hearn. Hmm. And you had to get his approval. You had to get his approval if you wanted to change hotels. He had his favorite hotels, and if you didn't want to go to his hotel, he was very unhappy.
You got to love it. Pat Riley to take an assistant coaching job with the Lakers is to get approval from Chick Hearn. I can't fathom that happening. Well,
that's exactly what happened, though. And then went on to have a great career. Good for him.
You know, you talked about kind of why it didn't work out with the Lakers in that third year. But usually a championship, which you got in 1980, that buys you some kind of runway. The common perception, Paul, that you read about in a lot of clips is that Magic Johnson didn't want to play for you. Magic Johnson got you fired. How close is that perception to the reality?
Well, I think it's close, but I don't think it's the whole truth, Chris. It's close enough that we were on a five-game winning streak. So there aren't many, you know, professional coaches who get fired on five-game winning streaks if they haven't done any, you know, thing personally wrong. And we played in Salt Lake City, and during the game, Magic was not responding to things I was saying to him. And the last play of the game, I gave him some defensive instruction, and he totally either disregarded or didn't do. So after the game, after we went into the locker room, I asked him to come into another empty locker room to tell him how I felt. I gave him the credit to not say it in front of his teammates. So I said to him, I said, Magic, this cannot continue. You cannot disregard me at crucial times in a game like you just did. And he just walked out, and he apparently got a hold of Jerry Buss and said, I don't want to play here anymore. So it kind of put Buss on the line, and I got fired the next day. So I guess you could say Magic Johnson got me fired. But I think that's unfair to Magic, because the Lakers were unhappy anyway. You know, they were almost looking for a reason to say maybe we should let Westhead go and do other things. They just weren't happy. We weren't winning enough, even though five-game winning streak's not bad. So I think Magic was the tipping point, but if they really wanted me, he wouldn't have been able to get me fired. So they used him to have me released. That's my opinion.
Do you have a relationship with Magic now?
Yeah, I mean, Magic, I see Magic, you know, different events and times. And he actually called me some months ago and invited me to go to Hawaii with the team. They're going to make have a celebration about the great Laker teams of the 80s. And he said, Coach, we absolutely want you to be there. And I really appreciated the phone call. And then it all got canceled or delayed because of the COVID situation. But yeah, I mean, my relationship with Magic now is fine.
You had bounced around in different spots in the NBA and back in college. I mean, did you have a preference of what was more enjoyable? Was just the NBA kind of a thing you aspired to? How would you view it?
Yeah. Well, I would say after 20 teams and 45 years of coaching, I would say I liked the teams that had good players.
It's funny. Every coach, I hear that a lot, yeah. There, Paul.
And the ones that, you know, you got, and the closet was half empty, and, you know, and all the good players just got traded or retired. And that's why you got the job. You see, that's kind of one of the things. Once you get fired in the NBA, the next job you get, it's probably not a very good one, because you're kind of damaged goods yourself. So you get second best. And then it kind of trundles the bad way. There were teams that I just liked. I mean, I liked my Denver Nuggets team. Even in my first year when we won the last week of the season, we won our 20th game. But they were delightful guys. They tried their best to run and press like I was doing in college. You know, they really did. And, I just had a bunch of guys that said, okay, we'll give it a try. But probably the best team I've ever coached, my system, is Loyola Marymount. I mean, when I was at LMU, those players, Bo Kimble, Hank Gathers, Corey Gaines, and they responded to what I wanted, and they liked it. You know, it wasn't like, oh, gosh, this crazy guy wants us to run more. No, they kept saying, give us more. We like this. We see that running fast beats teams. We see that teams get tired and crumble, you know, and they enjoyed that moment.
What was a young Mutombo like?
Yeah, he was terrific. He made me change my fast break. My fast break.
Oh, you mean you can't run with Mutombo?
I had to do it in a special way. But in my system, he couldn't take the ball out of bounds because, you know, it just was too skilled. You know, you have to learn that. and he couldn't be the what I would call my foreman to kind of trail the one and shoot 20-foot jump shots. Dikembe could not make a shot outside of 5 feet. Mm. You know, if everyone else left the gym, he couldn't make it outside of 5 feet. But I'm saying that in a critical way. But I loved Dikembe. I changed my break and had him run to the basket on every possession. And we would play Boston and against a very good Robert Parrish. And he'd go blowing by Robert Parrish at half court and get, you know, open layups. Dikembe averaged 19 points a game for me. And I think never again. Well, I got fired and he became, you know, a Hall of Famer. Probably his career average is under 10. Mm. But in my running system, Dikembe was terrific. You know, he'd play for my team because he liked to run. I enjoyed Dikembe. What a terrific guy.
Yeah. Oh, great guy. Always has been. As you kind of progress, you took different jobs in the ABA, you went to the Japanese League. When does the idea of coaching women become something you're interested in? Like, could you have ever envisioned yourself coaching a women's team, whether it's, I mean, in the 80s or before then?
No. To be honest, I mean, I saw one professional women's game in Los Angeles. My friend who coached with me with the Lakers, Mike Tebow, brought a team in town, and he called me and said, would you like to come and see our team play, and I can get to see you? And I said, yeah, that's okay, Mike. I'm not really interested in going to see the game. So I said no. And then my wife said to me, we could bring our granddaughter. She was like 12, and she was an athletic kid. You know, she played softball and soccer and volleyball. She said, it would be great to take her down and let her see what you know, women athletes can do. So I called him back. I said, hey, Mike, I changed my mind. I want to go to the game. So we sat at the bench, right behind the bench, and I saw this game. And my granddaughter, you know, had fun, and we talked to some of the players after the game. So it was a good family experience. So years later, when I'm out of work, I get a call, and the Phoenix Mercury calls and says, you know, would you be interested in coaching the women? And I went, oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I know the women's game. And I had seen one game. But when you're out of work, I mean, you have to, you know, the kids got to eat. So I take the job and I fly into Phoenix, and Diana Taurasi meets me at the airport. And we were driving to the press conference. She said, hey, coach, how you doing? I said, hey, good. Hey, thank you. She said, I have one thing to ask you. Treat us like you treat the guys. Don't water down the drills. Don't be nice to us. You just do exactly what you have done when you had your fast break team. So I said, okay. So we go to work. I do all the fast break stuff. We're into the season. We're like 3-8. And let me digress for a moment. If you're 3-8 with a guys team, college or pro, you're done. In fast break, you're done. Because they look at you and they say, you got us running up and down like a crazy man, men, and we're 3-8. We can go slow and we can't do much worse. So you see, you're stuck if you're a fast break coach. You really are. Because the only answer to a 3-8 team in fast break is go faster. And they're not going to. They just resist. Well, back to the women, we were 3-8. They said to me, you hang in with us and we'll hang in with you and we'll get this done. And sure enough, the next season we win a WNBA championship. So the women will follow the scheme longer than a men's team. That's for sure. But I won a championship with the Lakers and I won with the Phoenix Mercury. And what they had in common was I had the best players in the world. Mm. You know, I had Kareem and Magic, and you know, with Phoenix, I had Diana Taurasi and Cappy Pondexter from Chicago and Penny Taylor from Australia. So it comes down to that. If you have the great players and you have a good system, you can win.
Could Diana Taurasi have played in an NBA game?
I have no doubt. Yeah. Mm. I mean, she's good enough. And you know, and people always say, like, you know, over your experience, who are the five best players you'd ever coach? You know, who's the best and all that? And, you know, and so I said, well, I never coached Michael Jordan, but I still think he's the best. But I mean, I had Kareem and Magic Johnson. I had Dikembe Mutombo. I had Tracy McGrady. But Diana Taurasi would have to be in my top five. She would fit that world. She's that good.
What made her special?
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny you say that because, you know, she really didn't fit my fast break system.
Right.
She had okay speed. She didn't have great speed. She was a willing fast break player, but I don't think it was her favorite way of going about things. She was really more in the, and I'll make this analogy, in the Tracy McGrady world. Like, you know, just let me get down there and get me the ball and I'll score. I mean, why do I have to get down there so fast? I can score anyway. Mm. And it's funny, I make that comparison because when I was with Orlando with Johnny Davis as the head coach, I put in a system with him that if McGrady rebounded the ball defensively, he was the point guard for that play. So he would bring it, and he'd bring it real fast and real good. Otherwise, he wasn't really interested in running fast without the ball. So I did that with Taurasi, too. When she got a defensive rebound, she was the point guard for that play, and she would bring it and do marvelous things. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, they're very comparable players. But the X factor with Taurasi is she's very tough. She's feisty, you know, like she doesn't like anybody to get in her way. And if she's focused on winning, you know, get out of my way. And that would include basketball officials too. She has no love for officials, but she's the best. Yeah. If she's the best.
I think a few men share that, that sentiment as well with officials. I feel like, yeah. I've seen that happen more often than that. You also had a chance when you talk about the great players that you've worked with. I mean, you got to look at young Kevin Durant in Seattle, yep, and Oklahoma City. I mean, did you see him becoming, I mean, it's hard to say after 1.5 years, but did you see him becoming what he eventually became?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he could go down if he gets over this injury now. He could go down as, you know, in the top half dozen of all-time basketball players. No, I didn't see that coming. Mm. He was 18 years old when I showed up in Seattle. And he could score and he can do a lot of things. He had no interest in defending anybody. And I say that because, to his credit, PJ Carlissimo trained him. And by that I mean, we'd be in games and Durant would get, you know, he'd have 12, 14 points in the first quarter and he'd miss two or three defensive assignments and PJ would sit him down. And Durant was not happy with that, so 3 or 4 minutes go by and I said, hey, PJ, why don't we get Kevin back in? He said, no, to heck with him. Let him learn. So PJ was really hardballing Durant. Well, as what happens early into the next season, PJ gets fired. Durant goes on to become, you know, the great player that he is. But PJ really influenced the development of Kevin Durant. You know, he made him a more complete player. And Durant now, offense, defense, he can do both. He does do both. And one plays off the other. But I can't say that I saw Kevin Durant and said, oh my gosh, this guy's going to be, you know, a phenom. And the next year I was in Oklahoma City and saw Russell Westbrook too. And I had the same feeling. I thought he was a good player. He just drove to the basket with a vicious attitude. I mean, I love that about him. But I think Westbrook is marvelous from when he started to where he is now. I mean, he has. And the interesting thing about Westbrook, I'll say this. I saw him early on, and I went to PJ Carlissimo. I said, you know, PJ, we're going to have a problem because Westbrook doesn't shoot outside. He drives to the basket, like, viciously. But when he gets in the league, the big guys are just going to knock him down. Well, what I misread is he went so hard to the basket that the big guys got out of his way. No, this is the truth. The big guys in the NBA are afraid of Russell Westbrook. So when he says, ready or not, here I come, they get the hell out of his way. So that doubled his ability right from there, because he just put his head down and go to the basket, and it was wide open. It just opened up. So I didn't calculate that.
When was the last time you thought about coaching?
Oh, yesterday. I mean, I keep my wife says, you're retired. I said, no, I'm not. I'm just waiting for a phone call. But hasn't rang in a while. But I enjoy it. I watch my grandkids play.
Right.
It's fine. But, well, I hope I can begin to watch my grandkids again when this corona thing gets over.
Tell me about it. Well, the book is terrific, Paul. It's called The Speed Game. You've had an incredible career. You can buy it on Amazon, everywhere you can pick up books. Enjoyed the conversation, Paul. Thanks for joining me here on the show.
My pleasure, Chris.